Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As discussed in our last issue by lead investigator Dr. Michael Nant, an Austrian randomized trial just reported at ASCO demonstrated a stunning 35% reduction in recurrence rate in premenopausal women treated with zoledronic acid. I met with Dr. Nancy Davidson for her take on this and other recent research databases, and she began her conversation by commenting on the groundbreaking Austrian data set.
So, Neil, this was a very exciting trial for me to see at the plenary session. As you know, it addressed two questions in premenopausal estrogen receptor positive patients. It looked first at the question of optimal hormone therapy. And here the randomization was one between LHRH agonist as a form of ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen versus ovarian suppression plus aromatase inhibitor. And that particular comparison didn't show any benefit to the total estrogen deprivation. I think that was a surprise to many people because they thought it might be better, and it has turned out not to be, at least in this trial so far with this type of follow-up. So to me, that trial says that the SOFT trial and the TEXT trial, which are going on internationally, are absolutely vital. I think that we have to complete these trials in order to try to figure out what the optimal endocrine therapy would be. So I'm hoping that those who have been sort of thinking that they knew the answer to this question, that ovarian suppression plus aromatase inhibitor was going to be the best, I'm hoping they're taking pause and going back and realizing that, to me, this is still a very open question. The other thing that came out of the endocrine part of this trial that was pointed out, and which I think is important, is that these women in this trial, the Austrian trial, were almost exclusively women who did not receive chemotherapy. Only a couple percent as part of a neoadjuvant chemotherapy program. And, you know, the outcome for these women, Neil, was extremely good. So I'm hoping that the other thing that this trial will do is to reassure us that these young women don't always need chemotherapy. In fact, we should be guided a lot more by the biology of their tumor and a little bit less by our biases that perhaps youth means chemotherapy.
Yeah, I think it was like about 6% of the patients had
recurred. 5 or 6%.
5 years, you know, amazing. I want to ask you a little bit about how Oncotype and other genomic analyses might fit into these patients. But just to stay on the endocrine question, you know, another issue here would be if it turns out that these trials show equivalent effects in terms of recurrence, would there be an issue in terms of, you know, having another option to present to patients with a different side effects profile? One of the things that did come out in the Austrian trial was, as you might, I guess, expect in people made postmenopausal, that they did see more endometrial cancer and thromboses. Is that your take?
I agree with you that options are great, that I love to have choices, that I like to have choices that might have, in the best of all worlds, of course, they'd have optimal results. But if there are several things with the same results from an anti-breast cancer perspective, then I think having a number of choices with regard to toxicities is useful for doctors and for patients. The other thing you bring up, which I think is a critical one, is whether we're going to be able to either biologically better phenotype tumors or patients or both, because you might imagine that these therapies would be optimally targeted towards some kinds of cancers or perhaps some kinds of patients, some kinds of hosts. And with time, with some of these biological marker studies, perhaps we'll be able to figure that out. You know, whether it's CYP2D6 for tamoxifen or whether it's an Oncotype or a similar assay for the tumor, or whether it's going to be some merging of those two things. I think that's a very exciting area.
You mentioned CYP2D6. Do you think there's a practical, clinical, non-protocol role for that assay right now? Are you using it?
We are not routinely using it in our practice at Hopkins. I must say I'm following it with tremendous interest because we participate in one of the research networks that established what data exists right now about CYP2D6. And we're also looking very actively right now for similar kinds of markers that might predict for aromatase inhibitor response. I guess our sense has been that the data are not sufficiently strong right now to recommend that doctors routinely get CYP2D6 genotyping, so I have not been doing it.
So getting back to the Austrian trial and still sticking with the endocrine question for a minute, could you review what exactly the TEXT and SOFT trial randomizations are, and also what your take is on the issue of ovarian ablation or suppression in a non-protocol setting? Our patterns of care studies in the United States show that in general, the hormonal therapy being used in premenopausal women is tamoxifen, period. Of course, maybe it's a little bit different in Europe. What exactly is SOFT and TEXT looking at, and what about, where do you think tamoxifen alone stacks up?
I do believe that tamoxifen is the standard of care for premenopausal women who have receptor-positive breast cancer for whom you're going to consider hormone therapy. I think that the information is sufficiently robust right now that I do routinely discuss the controversies about ovarian suppression or ablation with patients and tell them what we know and what we don't know. And I'm a very, very strong backer of the SOFT trial. You remember that's the suppression of ovarian function trial. It's a trial targeted towards premenopausal receptor-positive patients who may or may not get chemotherapy. That's up to the doctor and the patient. But at the end of the day, they need to have a premenopausal estrogen level, and they're randomly assigned to either 5 years of tamoxifen, standard of care, or some kind of ovarian suppression or ablation, doctor and patient choice, with 5 years of tamoxifen, or the ovarian suppression or ablation with 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor, in this particular case, exemestane. So to me, this trial addresses what I think are the critical questions in endocrine therapy for young women right now. One is tamoxifen alone enough? And second is that if ovarian suppression turns out to be a better option, should you give it with tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitor? Huge trial, very important. The TEX trial is a sister trial. It's a practical trial, Neil, in the sense that although I've shared with you my sense that tamoxifen is the standard of care, not everybody agrees with me on that. So there are those individuals who think that combined endocrine therapy is the standard for these young women. And so that allows those individuals to have a patient go on a trial that randomizes between ovarian suppression or ablation plus tamoxifen versus ovarian suppression or ablation plus aromatase inhibitor. The other little nuance of that trial is that those women can also receive chemotherapy. If they do, the endocrine therapy is started with their chemotherapy. So it actually gives a period of concurrent chemotherapy and endocrine therapy.
Interesting. It sounds a little controversial.
A lot of question about that, of course, too. You know, I can argue it either way, that it makes sense to start two effective therapies simultaneously, or that if you strategize from the tamoxifen chemotherapy scenario in postmenopausal women, maybe you should be sequencing it. I think we just don't know the answer to that question right now.
So let's talk about the other part of the Austrian trial. When I heard that it was going to be presented, I immediately assumed it was going to be, I think a lot of people did, that it was going to be the endocrine issue that was presented or causing all the excitement. And then we saw that abstract posted and everybody took a deep breath.
Yeah.
What about the zoledronic acid?
Yep. So that trial had a second randomization, and it had to do with the use of zoledronic acid or not for a couple of years. So this was open label. It was not blinded, as I recall. I think the endpoint was a disease endpoint. I believe it was disease-free survival. And it was based on the sense from some previous trials on using clodronate, a related bisphosphonate, that perhaps the use of a bisphosphonate would have anti-neoplastic effects in addition to bone-preserving effects, which would be desirable when you're giving endocrine therapy to these young women. In the past, this group had already presented to us the bone effects and had suggested that using zoledronic acid can help to preserve bone density. So we knew that. And what was new this time was information to suggest that women who took the zoledronic acid had a longer disease-free survival, that they had fewer recurrences. And these were not only bone recurrences, which you might have predicted, but they saw fewer recurrences at other sites as well. So that's a really fascinating finding to me because it says a lot to us about what these agents might be doing. It talks to us about the whole problem of seed and soil with cancer. And so I think that all of us are beginning to think about how, if, when to integrate this. At the ASCO meeting, I must say I was personally very affected by the discussion of this abstract, which was offered by Martine Picard from Belgium. And her take on this particular comparison was that she thought that before she would embrace bisphosphonate routinely in her adjuvant practice like this, that she would like to see the outcome of other large randomized trials that are coming to an end. She had a very nice slide that pointed out that there are several of them, that they incorporate many thousands of women, and that if we're lucky, the first of those might come out even a little bit later this year. So I must say I took her counsel. I thought that this was a relatively small trial, and I, at least for the moment, have not been using zoledronic acid as a matter of routine in these premenopausal women. I'm waiting with interest to see the rest of these trials.
What about bringing this up as an option? Of course, there's also going to be a reimbursement and cost issue involved, but do you feel that at this point and this subset of women that it's something that they should be made aware of?
You know, I haven't been doing it yet. I have to say, Neil, a lot of times they're bringing it to my attention. Women of all types with early stage breast cancer are wondering about this because it did get a lot of publicity. And at least in our practice, we haven't been embracing it as a matter of routine. I guess I would really like to see some of the results of these other trials come out, because if you remember the Claudrenate data, there were three randomized Claudrenate trials that had been performed, two of which looked positive, but one of which looked not only neutral, but actually negative. So I think that I would like to see a little bit more here to guide me. It's of note that the intervention was pretty minimalist. It was twice a year, IV infusion, and the side effect profile, I think, was exactly what we might have anticipated, some infusion reactions. I don't believe that there was any report of excess renal toxicity, and they made a point of saying that they had not seen any osteonecrosis of the jaw, although, again, it's a pretty small sample size for that rare kind of side effect, it seems to me. But very exciting study. I'm really looking forward now to seeing the NSAPP study of Claudrenate and some of these other studies that are being done with Zoledronate. And in the U.S., I'm hoping that these results are going to give a boost to the SWOG trial that's going on currently that's looking at different bisphosphonate strategies in the adjuvant setting.
They actually were thinking the NSABP was going to report first, so they sort of figured, well, Claudrenate was out there. But I always thought, even before these data came out, it was a pretty cool study for patients to consider. I mean, particularly, I guess, people who are getting AIs in the postmenopausal situation. So the PI on that's Julie Grela, so I assume they're going to see a lot more interest in that.
I think that we are all hoping that that's the case, because you're right, it's a trial that involves everybody getting a bisphosphonate, and there had been some that had some reluctance about that. So this may make this a little bit more attractive scenario to both doctors and to patients.
I would think so. So let's talk a little bit about your work. And you had a paper at ASCO that I thought was really interesting, part of this whole project that you have at Hopkins, looking at ER and post-transcriptional events that hopefully you can explain better to me. But this paper at ASCO might be a good place to start, looking at people who'd received adjuvant anastrozole and looking at gene methylation in the contralateral breast.
Yeah. So we are excited about that work. The work that we're talking about is a merger of a number of things that we're interested in at Hopkins. One of them is this whole question about how to do prevention trials, because we all agree that we can't do them the way we've been doing them before. And so my colleague Verrett Stearns has been very interested in the possibility of using the contralateral breast as a kind of short-term model system to look at chemo prevention types of approaches. And of course, Verrett is also incredibly interested in looking at molecular markers of response and resistance and toxicity, both in the tumor and in the host. So this particular study is a study where women who were going to get an aromatase inhibitor, postmenopausal women who were going to get it as part of their adjuvant therapy, were asked to take that therapy, anastrozole, in the context of a trial that allowed us to collect a lot of data. And amongst the things that we asked patients to do was to undergo biopsy of the contralateral breast, the so-called normal breast. We were gratified that a lot of women stepped up to the plate and did that. That allowed us to get tissue from these women before they'd been exposed to the aromatase inhibitor and then after 6 months of exposure. We also have work that has to do with the breast density, with their bone density, with toxicity, with blood studies. But for this particular study, we looked at the tissue. And the question that was being addressed is whether some other work that we've been doing looking at methylation markers in breast tissue, whether that could be a useful way of trying to monitor response to a drug like an aromatase inhibitor, and whether these might be useful then in the prevention setting. So this was the first report of about 25 women where we had these matched samples and where we looked at the methylation status of multiple genes, about a dozen genes, that are frequently methylated in breast cancers. And what was found was that methylation of one or more of these genes was seen in 80%+ of these women who have these high-risk contralateral breasts. And then in about a half of them, if one used a quantitative measure for these methylation markers, one could see a decrease in the quantitative methylation index after this 6 months of therapy. Now, there's a lot that's left unstudied there, Neil. For starters, I don't know what would happen if you would take me, you know, who hasn't had breast cancer and who presumably doesn't have the same kind of high-risk profile. What are the methylation markers in my breast, and what would they be after 6 months if you didn't do anything? So this kind of work has to be worked out, sort of natural history. But there are individuals who had looked at this and who had suggested that high-risk breasts by several different criteria, for example, mutation carriers, that there may be more of this methylation. And so I think that there's an underlying science that supports this, and the rest of it will have to work out. We have some other work going on in follow-up studies and also in the remainder of the women on this study to try to help us sort this out further.
We started out our group in, you know, breast, lung, and colon cancer. And now we're just like into everything from myeloma to GIST to thyroid.
I mean, you're doing leukemia with Steve Gore.
Leukemia, right, Steve Gore from your place. So like each one of these things has all these molecular things that I've tried to figure out. Can you talk at a more basic level about what this might mean? I mean, I guess my understanding is these are what epigenetic changes that you're looking at, things that happen after the translation or production of protein?
Yeah, so they are epigenetic. And I think where we're coming from on this is that we think of cancers of all types, and breast is no exception, as an accumulation of genetic changes, so changes in the sequence of the DNA, and also epigenetic changes, which are changes that do not change the sequence of the DNA, but might change the transcription pattern of the DNA. So the epigenetic changes that we're the most interested in are either methylation, which is the addition of a methyl group to cytosines next to guanines in certain parts of the genome, particularly in the promoters of genes, so methylation. And there's also a tremendous amount of interest in changes in the histone proteins, which we used to think of as uninteresting, inert proteins that sort of hung out in the nucleus. And we now have learned that these are actually very dynamic proteins, that they can be changed on their amino acids, and that can then change how they associate with the DNA at gene promoters. So there's tremendous interest in these methylation markers, both because they might be markers of risk, but also because these kinds of changes are potentially reversible. And for all of us who are therapists, the notion that there's something that contributes to the carcinogenic process that you can reverse is extremely important. We're not going to reverse mutations, I don't think, Neil, but I think that we might be able to reverse epigenetic changes, therefore the excitement that there may be a marker and that there might be ways that you can undo the changes.
I think actually Steve Gore was talking about histone deacetylase inhibitors.
Yeah.
And then we were talking about what you all were doing in breast. But
right.
What do we know about these agents in breast cancer and what are they actually doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been most interested in our group in the histone deacetylase inhibitors. And we came at this, Neil, because as you know, I have a passion for estrogen receptor. I've been worried about why it is that some breast cancers don't express estrogen receptor, and that led us on a long series of laboratory studies where we showed that, at least in cell lines, and we think also in some breast cancers, that estrogen receptor silencing may occur because of these epigenetic changes, or it may be associated with these changes, both the methylation at the promoter and also changes in the histones that are associated with the promoter. So we've done a tremendous amount of work in cell culture showing that these changes exist in ER-negative cell lines and showing that you can undo them with DNA methyltransferase inhibitors like azacitidine or decitabine, clinically available drugs. And you can also undo them with some of the histone deacetylase inhibitors. And the one that has captured our interest recently is SAHA or vorinostat, for obvious reasons, since it's in the clinic. So what we've been able to show in cell culture is that you can reactivate estrogen receptor expression with these drugs, that the cells are now sensitive to tamoxifen in that it inhibits their growth, and it seems to promote changes that are suggestive of programmed cell death. Because of that, in our group, what we've chosen to do is do a short-term study of SAHA, of vorinostat, in women with newly diagnosed breast cancer in the preoperative setting, just 3 days of exposure to see whether or not we can modulate biomarkers in cancer in women in the same way that we do in the laboratory. Others have chosen more traditional ways of developing the drug, and I'm aware of 2 studies in breast cancer. One is from our colleagues at City of Hope, who used vorinostat in a classic phase 2 setting in women with advanced breast cancer, heavily pretreated breast cancer, and showed that it was well tolerated and that they had some disease stabilization in some women. And then the other is a recently reported study from our colleagues at Moffitt in Tampa, where they did a kind of phase 2 trial of tamoxifen plus vorinostat in preparation for a trial where you might actually look at this reactivation strategy that I was telling you about. And what they found was that they had a couple of partial responses in these women who were hormone therapy failures. And whether or not that reflects the effect of vorinostat alone or vorinostat plus tamoxifen remains to be seen. But they were able to show that it was extremely well tolerated, that it did seem to have some anti-neoplastic effect, and I think they've also set themselves up to do some biomarker discovery studies. So that's where we stand with this right now. The third place that we're going in our group is that there is some work to suggest that maybe these epigenetic modifiers would be especially of interest in triple-negative breast cancers, estrogen receptor-negative breast cancers, and so my colleague Verrett Stearns again has just launched a trial that involves looking at vorinostat with chemotherapy, particularly nab-paclitaxel and carboplatin, in the setting of either triple-negative breast cancer or women with estrogen receptor-positive breast cancers that have a very high risk profile, so relatively low expression. So the randomization is going to be in the preoperative setting, and it's chemotherapy with or without vorinostat, again with biomarkers and pathologic CR as being the primary endpoints.
But no hormone therapy?
No, because these are going to be women that are largely receptor negative, and you're right, we haven't integrated hormone therapy for this because we're trying to look at some of these biomarker modulation things without the complications of vorinostat, chemotherapy, and hormone therapy. It might be too much for us to fathom in one trial.
But that concept sounds very intuitive. You know, the idea of trying to make an ER-negative tumor sensitive to hormone therapy. What's the best case scenario about if this really works out, how long it'll take to get to the clinic?
Oh, several years, I think. And I think it would be important to disclose, Neil, that of course this wouldn't be a completely embraced idea, that there are many who are worried about whether this is going to work or not. You know, if you think about the origins of breast cancer and where these cells come from and stem cells and all this area that's being explored right now, it is conceivable that what we think is going on may not be going on. I think a lot of the parallel work that's going on with stem cells and with the molecular phenotyping is going to help us with that. But, you know, we are coming into the clinical trial process a little bit, as I talked about. I think that we have the wherewithal to try and figure out whether this makes sense as a strategy or not.
And I think another theme that you're hearing a lot of and is reflected in your comments is the pre-op or the neoadjuvant model as an area of discovery. Of course, the NCI had a major conference just on neoadjuvant therapy of breast cancer, but the idea of using this as a translational platform, I mean, breast cancer is way ahead of, you know, lung, colon, and a bunch of other tumors for a lot of different reasons. But again, this idea of bringing that in for endocrine therapy is interesting. It kind of made me think a little bit about some of the work that's being done in terms of using Ki-67. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Matt Ellis and also Mitch Dowsett, and the people from Europe are looking at this. The idea of starting a patient on hormonal therapy, I mean, it's kind of simple. I really didn't think about it. And looking at their Ki-67 in a couple of weeks and see if the tumor is getting turned off. What do you think about that?
I think that our European colleagues are way ahead of us on this, that not surprisingly, they're in the mainstream with regard to hormone therapy. I think the work from Mitch Dowsett is really quite compelling. And in fact, for the trials that we're doing with preoperative therapy, for example, with vorinostat, Ki-67 is the endpoint we chose. You had to choose something to design the trial and power it. I think the information that exists that suggests that changes in Ki-67 are ultimately associated with outcome with endocrine therapy in preoperative studies is pretty good. And so to me, that makes sense as an intermediate marker for us to use at the present time. I'm excited about that work. Even in some prevention work we're doing, Neil, with completely different interventions with some of these nutraceuticals, we've chosen to use Ki-67 because it's kind of the coin of the realm right now.
I want to ask you about the whole concept of ER-positive breast cancer, and particularly the issue of the long-term natural history and the ability to affect that. You've been part of a number of studies, including the MA-17 classic trial that looked at this issue, but sort of taking a step back now compared to maybe 5 or 8 years ago, what's your perception of ER-positive breast cancer and, you know, the types of strategies and clinical trials that we are going to need to be able to control this disease?
Well, first, I like the verb that you chose, control. That's good. I think that's a good choice for this. I don't know that my thinking has changed a lot over the last few years. I think that many of us were very struck a long time ago by the ECOG study published by Tom Safner and Doug Tormey looking at natural history of ER-positive versus ER-negative breast cancer. We're now talking over a decade ago, that suggested that they were a little bit different. Perhaps what's changed is that we appreciate it more now than we did then, and that we have some other things that we might be able to think about doing about it, the use of the aromatase inhibitors, for example. So I am increasingly a believer in long-term strategies for hormone-responsive breast cancer. I'm not sure how long-term is, and I do wish that there was a way that we could risk stratify it a little bit better. You know, when I come to the end of 5 years of tamoxifen and 5 years of aromatase inhibitor, for some of my node negative 1 centimeter estrogen receptor positive breast cancers, you wonder whether she really needed all that therapy. I guess for a few of them, you wonder whether she needs even more therapy. And I wish that we could sort that out better than we seem to be able to at the present time. I think this whole question of how long to give these therapies is really a huge issue for us right now. And it's going to be hard for us to address it because these studies require such long follow-up. I am hoping that perhaps some of this biomarker work that's going on is going to help us be able to hone that down a little bit over time so that we can be a little bit more focused about who we give these things to.
I guess another issue or a related set of data that came out over the last 6 months that's kind of interesting, maybe of historic value, but maybe biologic value, is the Atlas and Adam studies looking at tamoxifen for 5 years versus longer. How would you put together what we've seen there and kind of what it means?
I think we've seen preliminary data from both of them. I'm looking forward to seeing it in a more solid fashion. And I think that these are both obviously extremely large trials, so size is a huge benefit here. I'm not completely sure about the conduct of the trials. I mean, we'll have to see them written and see how they look.
Are there any situations right now, you know, for example, a woman who's on tamoxifen, tolerating perfectly, still having menstrual periods, 5 positive, 10 positive nodes originally, where you would discuss the option of continuing beyond 5 years right now?
I do it on an individual basis with patients like the one that you've described. I talk with them a little bit about, and this is relevant largely to our premenopausal patients, as you've pointed out, because other folks are often either starting or transitioning to aromatase inhibitor. But in these premenopausal women, when we hit the 5-year mark, we talk about the information that exists, which is not enormous, actually, until we get to these newer trials. And then we talk about 3 strategies. One is going on with tamoxifen on an annual basis. And we do reflect on the fact that I'm certain that it contributes toxicity, that I'm not quite sure what it contributes in terms of benefit. We talk about whether she just wants to quit enough already, that the bulk of the data that we have has to do with 5 years of tamoxifen. Or we talk about a kind of out there possibility, which is that she could transition to an aromatase inhibitor, which in her case then means using an LHR antagonist as well. And I've seen patients do all of them. I must say the most common one in my practice actually usually is quit because they're done. You know, they've already, in many cases, had chemotherapy. They've had 5 years of tamoxifen. They feel like they're ready to move on. But a few of them do opt to take tamoxifen on a year-by-year basis. And often, as you point out, it's those that perceive themselves at high risk. And I've had very rare individuals who have made the crossover to the hormonal blockade. I think that they have often felt that they didn't want to take on the side effects that were associated with it at that late stage in their illness.
Another subject of great discussion and concern is the woman who is premenopausal at diagnosis, gets chemotherapy, stops having her periods, remains chemically postmenopausal, remains clinically postmenopausal, finishes her 5 years of tamoxifen, and again, the question of an AI.
Yeah, I think all of us were really captured by Ian Smith's paper and others that have appeared looking at the late effects of aromatase inhibitors in these women and suggesting that in some cases they retain or regain ovarian function, including, as you know, the report that captures all of us, which is the woman who became pregnant. That certainly grabs your attention. Like everybody, you know, if we're going to do this, we might look at hormone levels. We certainly watch her clinically. We try real hard to make sure that we think that the benefit outweighs the risk. I think that there's some work going on right now through our pharmacogenetics network, through a trial that's going to be put together by Lynn Henry and Dan Hayes, that's trying to look at some of this, particularly in the setting of women who have amenorrhea that's related to chemotherapy. So how we might be able to give aromatase inhibitors in those women and how to kind of identify who's who. So that work is just sort of getting off the ground, so stay tuned.
Right now, clinically, how do you approach that issue?
Well, we sit around, first of all, as she finishes that 5 years of tamoxifen, and we talk about whether she wants to think about extended endocrine therapy or not. If she does, then I actually often will take people off of their tamoxifen for a few months and kind of see what's happening. First, I'd like to see how they feel when they're off tamoxifen so we know what their baseline status quo is. The second is if we take it away for a few months, we may see if their ovarian function kicks in either clinically or by laboratory parameters. And then we can use that to guide us. But I do take a little brief holiday after the 5 years of tamoxifen to let people see what their new baseline is. And if they are going to take the aromatase inhibitor, then we watch them fairly carefully. I've been following them largely clinically, although I've been giving some thought to whether or not one should follow them by laboratory studies. The key there, of course, is you have to have access to a lab that can do these really high sensitivity estrogen assays. Not every lab is geared up to do that.
How would an oncologist in practice know whether or not the lab that they're dealing with is doing that?
My sense is that the ones that talk to me seem to know it better than I do. They pretty much know the labs that they're working with. I think that a lot of the high volume labs have, you know, incorporated this. The person I've used as a reference on this is Mitch Dowsett in the UK to think with me a little bit about it. And he does point out that it is a really critical measurement issue, and you do need to try to sort this out with your labs.
You know, another issue that's coming out with the issue of long-term aromatase inhibitors is more and more attention being focused on the arthralgia syndrome. You mentioned Dan Hayes, and he has this whole project trying to understand what's going on. We're seeing papers coming out, you know, specifically looking at it. What's your take on what we've learned about this in terms of pathophysiology, and what's your clinical experience with it?
Yeah, work in progress. Again, we're part of that same network that Dave Flockhart from Indiana Hopkins, so it's a Hopkins, Michigan, Indiana network led by our Indiana colleagues. We are busy doing a trial right now looking at a randomization between two aromatase inhibitors, letrozole versus exemestane. Large trial, like 500 women. And there are a lot of biomarker endpoints, but as part of that, there's been some pretty rigorous prospective collection of quality of life and symptoms. And there were also some pre-existing requirements about what would be the kind of muscle and joint aches and pains that would require a rheumatologist evaluation. The things that are found are kind of all over the map. It isn't clear to me that there's a single thing that accounts for the pathophysiology here. What to do about it is, you know, also very complicated. And of course, the purpose of our study is in part to try to figure out whether there are ways that you can predict a priori that somebody would do better with one AI than the other, or perhaps that she would be more prone to these kind of musculoskeletal symptoms. I personally think they must have been relatively underreported in the large randomized trials that were done. And now that we have a larger experience and we're paying more attention to this, that we're seeing it. And I think it's critical because compliance is awfully important with these drugs. And if women aren't feeling well, you know, they may not be very compliant.
They may not also necessarily volunteer that information, too.
There's no question that you have to tease that out. It takes time to ask and to listen, and that patients may not want to volunteer it. I may not want to hear about it because then I have to think about how to solve it, so that people in both of the chairs in the exam room don't have a big incentive to want to discuss it.
As we start to kind of focus down on this syndrome, what sort of evidence do we have in terms of tachyphylaxis? You know, scientifically, do we know what fraction of patients it just sort of gets better?
No. I think that we hope that our randomized trial where we're following people prospectively is going to help us with that. We're also busy doing, we have built in place a crossover design. So if a woman starts on the one AI and tolerates it poorly, she can cross over to the other one. Because, of course, there's also been some question about whether it's truly agent-specific or whether it's class-specific. And so that might help us to be able to sort it out.
The last thing I want to ask you about is sort of where you see endocrine therapy going at a sort of phase 3 clinical trial type level. What are the strategies out there that are being tested that maybe could end up coming into clinical practice over the next 2 or 3 years in one way or the other? And two, and specifically I was curious about, one, even though we seem like we keep wanting to give up on combination hormonal therapy, is the issue of an AI in fulvestrant. And the other is the issue of endocrine therapy and biologic therapy, and a whole bunch of different biologics have been looked at. What about those two strategies and others that maybe oncologists in practice might end up seeing, you know, in the next couple of few years?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would point out is that in practice right now, I don't think there's any role for combination endocrine therapy, with the possible exception of an LHRH agonist plus tamoxifen for premenopausal receptor-positive breast cancer. All the other areas that you pointed out are incredibly interesting investigational areas. I think we should go after them. I am intrigued by the aromatase inhibitor fulvestrant possibilities. I guess that we should keep in mind, though, that we've done a lot of such combination trials in the past, and at the end of the day, we have never found that, in fact, there was much in the way of an additive effect, let alone some sort of synergistic effect, and certainly there were always toxicity issues. So I would look at that as very much of a trial question. I think a lot of the enthusiasm is what you pointed out, which is the knowledge that in most cancers, there's probably more than one pathway that's aberrant, and that we can inactivate or intervene with one pathway all we want, but then redundant pathways or other kinds of competing pathways are going to come to the fore. So it's probably going to be important to think about regulating more than one pathway simultaneously. So the areas that are getting tremendous play, as you know, are the possibility that one should think about combination therapy for the receptor-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer. And in fact, I think we're already doing that in the sense that we tend to use both trastuzumab and endocrine-based therapy in those patients. The second is this whole area of whether or not anti-angiogenesis therapies would be particularly useful in this setting, more than, again, just using two therapies that could add together. And so I think that those are also areas where we should stay tuned. A little bit of work looking at some of the other, like the mTOR pathways. I'll be interested to see how that plays out. I certainly had patients that were involved in some of those studies looking at those agents in conjunction with hormone therapy. So a lot of promise. Nothing that I see that's going to come into my clinical practice in the next couple of years that I can appreciate that we haven't already established, as, for example, steroid hormone-targeted therapy and trastuzumab.
There was a lot of interest and discussion, and Ken Osborne was one of the people talking about this, of combining hormone therapy with anti-EGFR TKIs, gefitinib, erlotinib, those types of agents. And what I had seen looked pretty not too exciting, but then there was a paper at ASCO that seemed like maybe it was a little bit more interesting. Did you see that one?
I have seen some of those. You know, I think that Ken's preclinical data are incredibly exciting on this. It makes a lot of sense. And I guess what's handicapped us so far is that those anti-EGF receptor therapies, at least on the surface, have not been very useful as monotherapy in breast cancer. And of course, they've had some difficulty, some of them, even in the setting of lung cancer. I think we also have some uncertainty about whether the small molecule inhibitors, you know, is that the way to go? Or should you be using antibody-based work, which I think we haven't worked out well in breast cancer? So I think there's some skepticism about anti-EGF receptor things as monotherapy, which we have to overcome if we're going to be able to test them in these combination therapies. And I think we're starting to see some of that work take place. Whether or not it's going to ultimately have clinical practice, I think, remains to be seen. There are all those patient selection issues that we were talking about earlier, because it doesn't look to me anyway like EGF receptor expression is really the name of the game here, and so I'm not quite sure what is.